tank showed the fusion signatures of Calvin, Goku, and Linus as they left the system. Linus had been okay with no noticeable twitchiness, but Calvin and Goku had been at each other's throats since day one. Maybe that explained Linus wanting to go off on his own. And yet, for all that they fought nonstop, Calvin and Goku seemed inseparable. They threatened each other constantly, but there'd never been any question of them splitting up. I could sympathize with Garfield, but it was 5 years since Riker and Homer left, and I'd been running out of excuses. It seemed Bob's reluctance to clone was contagious. We were turning out to be a pretty poor example of a von Neumann probe based on results so far. I shook my head and canceled the display. This cohort was the first using the version 3 ship design. Given Calvin and Goku's destination and the very high probability of their running into other probes, I had felt it necessary to beef up the ship specs. Heaven 9 and Heaven 10 were equipped with massively oversized surge drives and reactors, giving them an unheard-of 10G maximum acceleration. The ships also contained a second, smaller, and very well-shielded reactor, which would allow them to coast through a system with the main reactor turned off. Undetectable, except at very close range. On the matter of weapons, they were equipped with twice the normal number of busters, several scouts, as well as railguns powered with the oversized surge drives, and steel-jacketed lead cannonballs for ammunition. And finally, I had added what I hoped would be effective Sudar jamming. Twin emitters, powered by oversized reactors, should overwhelm any Sudar detectors in range with white noise. There had been a lot of discussion and debate about investigating the Alpha Centauri system. It was the obvious first stop for a space probe, and it was likely that at least one of the other superpowers had chosen it as their first destination out from Sol. Faith had, in fact, decided against Alpha Centauri for exactly that reason. The subjective elapsed time for colonists would only be about 6 months different for a trip of 4 light years, or 10. I had no idea how a Chinese or USE encounter might play out, but we were unanimous on Medeiros. No warning, no quarter, no discussion. 23. Milo. February 2153. Omicron Squared Eridani.
However, in the last several years, 3D printers have become increasingly common. The technology is still in its infancy, but companies have already performed demonstrations by, for instance, printing words on a substrate using individual atoms. This is seen by some as the beginning of the beginning for real, practical, self-assembling manufacturing systems. A printer can build more printers, robotic workers, miners, and ultimately more von Neumann machines. A few companies are experimenting with print heads capable of delivering multiple materials, kind of like color inkjet printers. The technology should continue to improve until they have something that can deliver any element, atom by atom.
Edward Geipers, from the convention panel, designing a von Neumann probe.
It was time to go. I leaned back in my chair, looked around at the clouds, the French countryside below me, and Lucy, curled up on her cushion, dreaming whatever dogs dream of. I'd spent a fascinating 7 months examining and cataloging the biologies of Romulus and Vulcan. All my observations, every report, every image, had been uploaded to the space station and forwarded to Bill and onward to Sol. Drones had quartered the system and identified every pocket of ore worth bothering with. I'd left an auto factory and drones which would continue to refine raw resources, pending the arrival of colonists. Or aliens? Or maybe another probe? With that thought in mind, I'd also supplied a squad of busters. The station AMI had a profile of Medeiros and orders to ram on site. I decided I didn't want to build a batch of Bobs here. Any colonists would need the resources more than me, and anyway, I wasn't sure if I wanted to be bothered. Hadn't really worked out all that well for Bob 1. I took my time, examined all the local stars, and decided on 82 Eridani. It was a good prospect, and not too long of a trip. I squirted off a final report indicating my intentions and took a final look at the system representation in the holotank. Then I put on the road again, full blast, and fired up the surge drive. In the village below my airship, French peasants cursed at me.
24. Riker, April 2157, Seoul.
Speed is the essence of war. Take advantage of the enemy's unpreparedness, travel by unexpected routes, and strike him where he has taken no precautions. Sun Tzu, Art of War. We came into the solar system at 5% of C, decelerating at a steady 2.5 G. We had carefully calculated our trajectory and approach speed so that we appeared to be arriving from Epsilon Eridani. A projection forward would have us pass very close to the sun, still moving at about 0.1 C. We had chosen our approach vector after much deliberation. We needed something that posed a threat to the Brazilians, but that would allow them to intercept us. A course that performed a slingshot around the sun would allow the incoming heaven vessels to emerge on the far side with a huge advantage in velocity and an unpredictable vector. The Brazilian vessels would not be able to simply sit and wait for us to come around. Well, that was the theory. We hoped that we could draw all six Brazilian probes into the pursuit. I sat in my ready room, nervously watching the telemetry. We had just passed the point where the Brazilians would have detected our fusion signatures, allowing for light-speed lag. In another 6 hours, it would be impossible for them to intercept us. If the Brazilians decided to stand and fight instead of pursuing, we would have to consider withdrawing. A straight-up toe-to-toe duke-em-up was not to our advantage. An hour passed before we saw movement. I had briefly experimented with having my VR self actually sweat, but had given it up as a human experience I really didn't need to relive. We let out whoops when four of the fusion signatures began to pull away from the asteroid line. Four isn't six, I said, but we have a lot better chance against two in a face-off.
Assuming we can knock off the first four,
Homer added. Nothing's ever a sure thing, I guess. It would take 10 days to reach perihelion in our race around the sun.
It's time.
I looked up at Homer's announcement. He looked back at me, expectantly. Okay, let's do it. Guppy, launch the busters.
Aye.
The floating display depicted the Heaven 2 launching busters, spaced a few seconds apart directly aft. The railgun had been designed into the version 2 Heaven ships so that items could be launched fore or aft, with an impetus of hundreds of Gs. Each launch left the ship in momentary freefall while the surge drive powered the railgun, but we hoped that, at this distance, the Madeira wouldn't be able to detect the momentary blip in deceleration. The busters would fall far enough back to be behind the Brazilian ships when their trajectory brought them in behind us. With their reactors off, running on stored power, the busters would be undetectable, unless the enemy deliberately did a focused sudar sweep in that direction. The Brazilian ships had just pulled in behind us as their trajectory merged with ours. I examined the diagram floating in the middle of my VR. The interactions were complex. We were decelerating at 2.5 G while we tried to make a slingshot maneuver around the sun. The Brazilian ships were accelerating at 2 G while trying to get close enough to us to lock and launch missiles, without going so fast that they were forced into a higher orbit. Meanwhile, the busters floated silently behind the Brazilian ships in freefall, but with a greater velocity and no deceleration, therefore gradually closing in. The busters had to get as close as possible before they turned on their reactors, and we wanted all the action to happen on the opposite side of the sun, invisible to the two Brazilians who were still shepherding asteroids. Finally, the Brazilians acted. Each ship launched a missile. The missiles, as feared, were surge-equipped and shot toward us with monstrous acceleration.
"Contact in 45 seconds,"
ordered the trailing busters to attack.
"Aye."
A tooltip went up on the hologram indicating that the order had been sent. Within seconds, 8 data points lit up as the busters' fusion reactors came online. The Brazilians reacted immediately, launching a wave of missiles to aft.
"Well, here's where things get real," Homer said.
I sensed the millisecond blips as my railgun launched busters aft to intercept the incoming missiles. Homer and I launched four each. As they had been programmed to do, the busters paired up, one behind another, with each pair homing in on one incoming missile. As the second wave of Brazilian missiles separated from the ships on the display, I could see that they had launched eight at the pursuing busters. According to our estimates, they should still have a total of four in reserve. The pursuing busters went into a complex corkscrew pattern designed to make it as difficult as possible for the defensive missiles to lock on. Meanwhile, the Brazilian ships had split, forcing the attacking busters to select a target. I had a few seconds of relative inaction, so I aimed a highly focused sonar ping at one of the Brazilian ships. The return carried a gratifying amount of detail. Among other things, I saw that the ship was indeed out of missiles. Empty missile bays indicated that it had room for four. I sent an aside to Homer. 16 missiles total as expected. I turned my attention back to the approaching ordnance. Three of the Brazilian missiles each collided with a buster, annihilating both. The fourth missile managed to avoid the lead buster. However, in doing so, it left itself open to a broadside from the trailing unit of the pair. There was an explosion and the fourth missile ceased to exist. The multiple explosions saturated the video view and created a chaotic soup for radar and sonar. During that brief interval of relative blindness, Homer and I fired eight cannonballs at full power. When the image cleared, I could see that we'd destroyed all four missiles and still had four busters left. At the other end of the field, the eight Brazilian missiles had destroyed all eight pursuing busters. No doubt the Brazilians were congratulating themselves on their fine shooting, but the purpose of those busters had been to use up their missiles. Medeiros's behavior in Epsilon Eridani had shown that he was willing to sacrifice himself if he saw he couldn't win. We wanted this group to use up their ordnance defending themselves instead of launching a suicide attack. They still had four missiles in reserve and four busters bearing down on them. We waited, trying to project an out-of-ammo vibe. A stalemate here would be a win for the Brazilians. And finally, they committed. The Brazilians fired their last four missiles at the oncoming busters.
"Checkmate!" Homer yelled.
Intent on the approaching busters, the Brazilians had failed to detect the cannonballs. Totally inert with no radio or fusion signature, the cannonballs were invisible, unless the Brazilians picked that specific moment to do a sonar sweep. Six of the eight cannonballs found their targets, just as the last wave of missiles and busters destroyed each other. We followed up with more cannonballs until telemetry indicated no activity in the enemy craft. After days of preparation and waiting, the actual conflict had come down to who had more ammo. Homer and I did omnidirectional sonar sweeps, looking for any tricks or traps that the Brazilians might have unloaded before they were destroyed. A second sweep checked the area around the wreckage of the enemy ships. Finally, satisfied that nothing awaited us, we eased over and checked for any still operational or partly destroyed busters. Homer thought this was funny.
"Going to give them a proper burial?"
"No," I responded. "I'm going to try to build a couple more busters. I've got the parts, except I'm a little short on massive balls of solid steel." Homer chortled like a kid who had just made a potty joke.
"Balls of solid steel,"
he snorted. I sighed, and the words "friendly fire" flashed through my mind. "Homer, we've got six busters left, and the two Brazilians have four missiles each, if they're provisioned the same as the four we just destroyed. Not only can we not do the pairing up thing to defend against the missiles, but we don't have enough busters to take out the missiles and the ships, even if our luck is perfect. So I'm going to try to rebuild some busters, and I'm going to scoop up a bunch of scrap from the battle as well for railgun ammo. You might want to do the same." Homer looked thoughtful for a moment, then nodded. Phase two of the assault involved sneaking up on the two remaining Brazilian ships. We had deliberately chosen an approach around the sun that would require us to come around the other side at full 2.5G acceleration in order to get to Earth. And we had been very careful not to display our full 5G capability since coming in system. Now we applied every erg of power to bending our course before we came around from behind the sun.
"Shut down in 5 seconds."
I shut down my VR. In a few seconds, both ships would go dark. We would shut down the surge drives and go ballistic. We would stop using Sudar and shut down the fusion reactors. As far as the Brazilian ships would know, we and our pursuers had annihilated each other. When they didn't see us come out the other side on the expected trajectory, hopefully they would relax their guard. For 2 days, we would drift, surviving on power cells. We would lower our frame rates to minimum in order to save every milliwatt of power. The roamers would be set to refining the scraps from the battle into cannonballs for the railgun. But as each roamer ran its power cell down, it would be shelved. We would power up only when we had put Earth directly between us and the Brazilians.
Shut down.
I felt the ship go dark. I cranked my frame rate all the way down.
We have arrived.
Report.
Orbital insertion was successful. We are coming up on a point directly on the other side of Earth from the enemy ships.
Excellent. As soon as we're sufficiently shielded, start everything up and accelerate to keep us in their blind spot.
Aye.
As power came up to full, I restarted my VR and relaxed into my captain's chair. Homer popped up in a video window.
I see you survived the trip.
I nodded to him. Let's get the mission status up in the tank, Guppy. The holotank filled with a schematic showing the Earth, the location of our ships, and the location of the two Brazilian ships, and the four asteroid masses that they were shepherding.
Positions of enemy are extrapolations, but are high probability, based on orbital mechanics and most recent observations.
That's fine, Guppy. Our biggest problem will be if the Brazilians play hide-and-seek behind the asteroids that they're herding. If they fire their missiles from hiding, they won't have a lock-in, and we'll have to depend on the missile's AMI, which we've already established is not very smart. We can set our busters to seek and destroy, but they don't have explosive warheads. Without a good head of steam, they won't be able to penetrate the hull, let alone do any internal damage.
If we're that close, we can use railguns,
Homer said. True, but we have to be careful with our ammo. We came around the Earth already doing over 150 kilometers a second. The Brazilian ships might or might not have noticed us right away, but they had 6 hours to see us and prepare for our arrival. We were still only revealing a maximum 2.5G acceleration. Let them expend energy wondering how we managed to get behind Earth. When we were still 5 minutes away from the lead asteroid, we received a hail from one of the Brazilian ships. I put the call up on the holotank while Homer observed. The video was a still image of the Brazilian flag. No avatar, I guess.
You have shown better than we expected from a couple of faith babacas. However, now you are coming to us. You will not be so lucky this time. We will litter space with your corpses.
I looked at Homer in surprise. That's not Major Medeiros. Who is that? This is Commander Riker of the Faith Space Navy. To whom am I speaking?
I am Captain Matthias Araujo. I will be the last voice you hear.
Without further commentary, the sender disconnected. Homer and I exchanged looks. After a pause, Homer said,
So what do you think is going on?
I thought about it for a moment. I don't know. But that deep scan I did just before we destroyed our pursuers showed all fabrication systems had been removed to make room for the larger surge-based missiles. I didn't think that through at the time, but now it looks like this may have been a last-ditch effort on the part of the Brazilian Empire. Maybe they were getting stomped and the probe project was all they had left. They volunteered some guy, someone disposable, stuck his replicant into the ships and tried to use them as gunships. Homer cocked his head.
Which might mean they didn't have time to give this guy a lot of training in being a replicant, and these ships may be all that's left of the war.
Missiles launched.
We checked our telemetry. The Brazilians had launched 8 missiles.
Damn. Exactly what we hoped they wouldn't do,
Homer said.
Guess they aren't that inexperienced.
Or they're just pissed. Or they have more missiles. However, their timing is terrible. They waited too long, and we're now close enough to use the asteroids. Follow my lead. Instead of launching countermeasures or attempting to flee, we did a hard turn and dove down below the asteroid. As soon as we were out of line of sight, we fired a load of smaller metal detritus from our aft railguns at a speed that left the space junk at a dead stop in our wake. As the pursuing missiles came around the end of the asteroid, they ran head-on into the stationary flotsam. Three missiles detonated immediately, which, unfortunately, cleared the junk for the trailing missiles. "Watch forward while I take out the rest of this batch," I said to Homer. As I was preparing my busters for launch, Homer said,
"Launch is from up front. Looks like they had more missiles. I think we're screwed."
I spared a millisecond to review the situation. I had five missiles coming in from the rear. I could take two out, possibly three, with the railgun. Homer had eight missiles coming in from the front. That meant 13 missiles against 11 busters, to say nothing of the Brazilian ships, which we would still need to deal with. It was very likely that the Brazilians had used everything they had by this point. We were far too close to them for any further missile play.
"We have to cut the numbers of the frontal attack. I'll give you all my busters. Save two.
Try to knock as many out with shrapnel as you can." I launched all my busters and handed control of five over to Homer, who sent them forward. I concentrated on the five missiles coming up from behind me, sending wave after wave of junk into their path. I had destroyed two when I realized that two of the three remaining missiles had crowded together trying to avoid a volley. I immediately sent a buster toward the nearest one at full acceleration. There was a flash, and both the missile and the buster were destroyed, but, yes, the other missile had been knocked out by the explosion. It was drifting aimlessly.
"They're getting a little close," Homer said. "Little help? Any time?"
"Almost done. Hold tight." As I sent a huge wave of shrapnel at the final missile, Homer yelped,
"Crap!"
and his signal went dead. I split my attention between my one missile and Homer's battlefield. Homer had taken out almost all of his missiles, but one had exploded far too close. It appeared to have damaged, but not obliterated, Heaven 6. However, the ship was adrift with everything offline. A couple of busters had circled around and chased the two final missiles from the front, but only one was anywhere near close enough to do any good. At that moment, a flash from aft indicated that my last volley had taken out the one remaining chase missile. That left me with one extra buster, but I wouldn't be able to get around to the front in time. They're not very smart. The thought came from nowhere, seemingly irrelevant, but original Bob had always trusted his hunches, and I reacted immediately. I fired a salvo of shrapnel, not directly at a missile, but just to the side opposite the pursuing buster. In true reflex action, the missile veered away from the shrapnel stream. That was all the buster needed to catch up. I was now able to concentrate a burst of shrapnel on the other missile and take it out. I looked back to the one missile left, the one that my buster had caught up with, and realized I had a problem. The busters depended on kinetic energy to destroy their targets. High-speed ramming, basically. This buster had instead run down a missile that was just as fast as itself. Now the buster and missile were flying together, with the buster repeatedly and ineffectually bumping the missile. It was interfering with the missile's trajectory, but not causing any damage. "Stop trying to have sex with it, idiot!" I sent a command to the buster, causing its reactor to fail catastrophically. The release of plasma and energy was more than enough to liquefy both units. I did a quick inventory. I had two busters left, and two enemies. There was no time to deal with Homer at the moment. I called the busters home and did a full ping, trying to locate the Brazilian ships. One of them was less than 2 seconds away, heading right for me. With a jolt, I realized he intended to ram. With no time for a formal calculation, I had to wing it. I accelerated upward at a full 5G. Either the Brazilian would be able to turn to intercept, or he wouldn't. 2 seconds later, the Brazilian passed by my stern, still attempting to change course. And 2 milliseconds after that, a buster passed through the Brazilian craft, right where the computer core was located. The Brazilian craft's drive turned off, and it began to drift. I pinged again, but got no return from the last ship. Either the ship had been destroyed in some unknown manner, or it was hiding behind one of the asteroids. We had shown our hands during the battle, so the Brazilian would know that it couldn't win a straight foot race. That meant it was hiding, hoping to keep the asteroid between us. I was out of railgun ammo. I had one buster left, but the buster wasn't going to be much good if it had to chase the Brazilian around the asteroid. I examined the return from my last ping and spotted what I'd been hoping for. The steel ball from one of the defunct busters. I sent out a couple of roamers, collected it, and loaded it into the railgun. The steel balls had been deliberately sized so that they could double as railgun ammo. I sent the buster out at an angle that should give it a clear view of the other side of the nearest asteroid. Sure enough, remote telemetry spotted the Brazilian ship just as he spotted the buster. He took off around the asteroid in the opposite direction. Bangarang, mofo. It took a millisecond to calculate his trajectory. I sent the ball off at full acceleration just as the enemy vessel came into sight. The Brazilian had no chance at all. The steel ball, backed by the full power of my railgun, punched through the ship at close to relativistic speed. The impact literally tore the ship in two, imparting opposite spins on each half as they drifted away. There was a flash as the reactor lost containment and one of the segments slumped and deformed from the centrifugal force. That's for Homer. My roamers sent back detailed views as they investigated Heaven 6. Homer appeared to have been very lucky. A fluke piece of shrapnel had cut off power to his computer core. Though there was significant structural damage, the actual core systems were intact. The reactor had been able to effect a graceful emergency shutdown when control disappeared. One of the purposes of the roamers was to repair and maintain the Heaven vessels, and I activated that program for Homer's roamers. Pfft, Homer's roamers. Jeez, I'm starting to sound like him. It occurred to me that I could now decorate my hull as Bob One had. Three for me, three for Homer. Better make that a priority. I had several tasks on the go. While some roamers worked on Heaven 6, others investigated the asteroids to find out how the Brazilians guided them, and a third group collected flotsam from the area of the battle. Raw materials were free for the taking in asteroids, but already refined material was well worth the trouble of scavenging. The Brazilian hulks in particular would be good for a lot of salvageable material. The second group of roamers began to report back, and I examined the scans as they came in. The asteroids, it turned out, were being chivvied by a low-intensity wide-field surge drive. The design ensured that the entire asteroid could be accelerated as a unit, without tidal forces or field drop-off tearing the body apart. It was an ingenious system, and I took copious scans for transmission to Bill. If he hadn't already started moving Kuiper bodies toward Ragnarok, these designs would be very helpful. Which was all very interesting, but the asteroids were still heading for Earth. If these bodies all struck the planet, even bacteria wouldn't survive the results. The Brazilians had set up the trajectory near perfectly, and there was no chance of a miss. I had to hope that I could impart enough sideways thrust on the asteroids using their surge drives to change that. But first, I had to get them to obey me, and I didn't have the encryption keys that the Brazilians had been using to transmit commands to the asteroid drives. Well, easily fixed. I ordered the roamers to simply rip the drive controllers out and hotwire the drive systems. No finesse or delicate electronics was required for a straight full-power sideways thrust. It remained to be seen if I was starting too late. Wake up, buddy. You okay?
NTM, NTM.
Homer's VR came online, smiling.
I guess we got him.
I snorted with relief. And their little dog, too. Homer steepled his fingers in a properly evil, mastermindish pose.
Oh, their base are belong to us.
We laughed together, maybe the first time since Homer had been born that we'd been in sync like that. I had a sudden jolt of what might be described as fatherly pride. Okay, that's weird. Snap out of it. Homer waved a hand in a vague out-there gesture.
So, what do we have?
I'm still evaluating, and by the way, in case you haven't checked, your back is still broken, so don't be trying to fly anywhere just yet. Guppy estimates 3 more days to get you shipshape. Homer bobbed his head, and I continued. The signs of war are everywhere. Nukes were definitely used, both planet-side and space-side, and I mean a lot. It looks like everyone just went toe-to-toe and started throwing punches until only one side was left standing. As far as I can tell, the only technological force left in the whole system was a small group of Brazilian probes that had been modified for war. I found the manufacturing area. It had broken down, and the Araujos couldn't repair it because they hadn't been loaded with the auto factory software or equipment. They couldn't land and bring someone upstairs to fix it. Not that I'm sure there's anyone left to do it anyway. And they couldn't build a lander or shuttle because no auto factory. Classic Catch-22.
So they were doing what, running around smashing things instead?
Homer grimaced. Pretty much. Taking revenge on their enemies. The asteroids had all been timed to target China, so I'm guessing that's who took out the Brazilian Empire.
Took out? How bad?
Pretty bad. It's actually kind of hard to tell exactly how much damage there is because of all the cloud and dust cover. Asteroid strikes and nukes kicked up a lot of dust, and it's just trashed the weather patterns.
There were other asteroid strikes? These weren't the first?
No, not by a long shot. But these were the biggest, I think. I've been able to make out dozens of impact sites, most around the size of the Barringer crater. These four would have been extinction level, Yucatan crater size.
Four of them.
Yeah. I shook my head in disbelief. I can't believe anyone would think that this was a reasonable response to anything. I feel no regret or guilt for ending those guys.
Is anyone left on Earth?
I put a globe of the Earth up in the holotank and sent a copy to Homer. I haven't been able to pick up any radio transmissions or reactor signatures, but then you wouldn't expect anyone to want to attract attention. I'm sure the Araujo gang dropped a rock on anyone they detected. By now, everyone still alive has gone to ground. Homer rubbed his forehead, his eyes unfocused.
What'll we do? I guess we could transmit an announcement, but some might just see that as a trick.
He idly poked a finger at his copy of the globe and spun it to show different views. He sat back after a few seconds, then put his hand to his chin and resumed staring into space. I waited, content to let him work through whatever he was wrestling with. Finally, he looked up.
We can use Sudar, to a certain extent, but atmosphere and planetary mass will play hell with the resolution. What about the exploration scouts that Bill came up with?
Funny you should ask, I responded with a smile. I'm building some as fast as I can. I stopped smiling and continued in a more serious tone. We need to sweep for surviving groups as quickly as possible. Between the nukes that were used and the rocks that were dropped, Earth looks like it might be spiraling into a nuclear winter. Anyone still alive might starve to death over the next couple of years.
But what will we be able to do if we find survivors?
I don't know, Homer. I shook my head, reluctant to meet his gaze. We're going to have to take this one step at a time. We watched as the fourth and last asteroid slid past the Earth. Although we'd known for a while that they would miss, this was an emotional moment. The original drive controllers had been replaced with more cooperative hardware, which was now programmed to gradually push the asteroids into long period orbits with a high inclination that wouldn't intersect Earth's orbit in the future.
One less thing to worry about,
Homer said with a smile.
We are being hailed.
We looked at each other in surprise. What now? 25. Bill. September 2151. Epsilon Eridani.
All that's really missing is a good artificial intelligence to control the whole process. And that's the trick, isn't it? These types of blue-sky discussions always assume certain advances for a successful implementation. Unfortunately, AI is the bottleneck in this case. We are close with the replication and manufacturing processes, and we could probably build sufficiently effective ion drives if we had the budget. But we lack a way to provide enough intelligence for the probe to handle all the situations that it could face.
Edward Guypers, from the convention panel, Designing a von Neumann Probe. I listened carefully to the telemetry coming over the radio link. Garfield was over 5 light minutes away and receding at a respectable 2,000 kilometers per second. The time signal in his telemetry fell behind at a steady, predictable rate. Well, I hadn't really expected to prove old Einstein wrong at this late date. It was the other signal that I was excited about. I was receiving a subspace signal from Garfield that originated with the same telemetry, transmitted at the same time, but The time stamp on that signal still exactly synchronized with mine to the limit of accuracy of our systems. I could tell I was grinning like an idiot. VR had long since become so realistic that it might as well have been real life, and that included aching facial muscles. Okay, Garfield, radio telemetry has you coming up on 6 light minutes away. Can you confirm my echo?
Yep. The return is just over 11.5 minutes behind my transmission.
Garfield's voice held the same excitement. He'd been working with me for several years now on multiple projects, including this one. We turned into a regular Skunk Works, and this was our biggest breakthrough by far. Cut the transceiver loose, Garfield, and come on back. We'll let the unit continue outbound for a few weeks and see what the dropout is like.
No problem.
Without warning, Garfield popped up in my VR, sitting in his beanbag chair. I jumped.
How the hell?
He laughed at my reaction.
Ha! One up, you old man. Take that.
You integrated the VR into the subspace comms? I felt a slow smile spread across my face. That was pretty impressive work. His bobbing eyebrows were answer enough. Then he frowned and thought,
this tech isn't going to make the space stations obsolete, is it?
Not a chance, I shook my head. We'll have to wait until someone builds one at the other end, but theory says the signal dropout will be almost total after about 25 light years. We'll have to use the space stations as routers.
The internet goes galactic,
Garfield laughed. Hey, with IPv8, we should be able to address every galaxy in the universe. I knew I was preaching to the choir. After all, Bob, right? But I have a tendency to think out loud.
That's fine, Bill. When do you think we'll be ready to transmit plans?
I think we should send what we have right now. It's still clunky, but once they've built it at the other end, they don't have to wait years for the next update. We grinned at each other across the virtual table. This changed everything.
26. Riker. April 2157. Sol. The signal was audio only and very weak.
Unknown ship, do you copy?
I looked at Homer and raised one eyebrow. He shrugged.
As good a place to start as any.
Activating my transmitter, I responded. This is the Starship Heaven 2 of the United Federation of Planets, Commander Riker speaking. There were several seconds of silence.
Uh-huh. Listen, I don't know who you are, but you've just apparently averted a global catastrophe, so I guess I'm willing to give you the benefit of the doubt. Our telemetry is not up to military snuff, but our systems tentatively identify you as similar to the Heaven Series interstellar probe that Faith launched a couple or three decades back.
Guilty as charged. And to whom am I speaking?
I am Colonel George Butterworth of the United States of Eurasia Army Corps. Rest assured, Commander, that our true position is obfuscated. If you attempt to destroy the source of this transmission, you will achieve nothing.
The Colonel's accent was definitely British and far too close to the cliched pronunciation portrayed in many American TV shows. I would have to be careful not to let Homer talk to him. I doubted Homer would be able to resist the urge toward mimicry. Colonel, let's not get off on the wrong foot, okay? We have no intention of blowing anyone up. We had a little disagreement with what appears to have been the last of the Brazilian Empire Space Navy. Now, I think it's time to start fixing things. We had been in discussions with the USE military for 3 weeks now. I was faithfully forwarding recordings of everything to Bill. Negotiations were slow and cautious, mostly on the part of Colonel Butterworth. He had been very slow to accept the idea that Homer and I weren't dyed-in-the-wool faith theologues. It took a very frank discussion in which I explained in detail the reasons for my atheism before the Colonel really began to believe me. The USE refugee camp that Colonel Butterworth had under his care consisted of about 20,000 people, mostly civilians, who had been collected into an underground military installation when the space bombardments had started. The Colonel guessed the global human population at less than 20 million at this point, although he admitted the uncertainty on that estimate was huge. Some of the refugees were scientific personnel who had been working on a USE colony ship back before the war. In the 22nd century, things were constructed in virtual space, first. Once complete, the plans were uploaded to an auto factory which built the entire item using 3D printers, roamers, and nanites.
The colony's ship plans were ready, needing only a space-based construction yard and a destination. The colonel informed us that the Chinese and USE probes had launched shortly after Bob 1, but the USE probe had never been heard from again. The colonel and I were conversing via video link, as usual. He knew that the Heaven vessels were staffed by replicants, as were the USE and Brazilian probes. However, we were the first to have a full-on VR avatar that looked and behaved like a human being. The colonel was having a little trouble accepting at a visceral level that I wasn't real. I toned down the Enterprise theme and stopped making Star Trek references out of courtesy. It blew me away that almost 200 years after Shatner first famously didn't actually say, "Beam me up, Scotty," people still knew Star Trek. Now that's a franchise. At the moment, the colonel was bringing me up to date on recent history. If we were going to make an attempt to save the human race, I wanted to have the whole picture.
"There was never actually a point where you could say, 'Now we're at war,'" the colonel explained. "International tensions had been high for quite a number of years. The confrontation over the attempted destruction of Heaven One was simply the tipping point. Each act prompted a reaction, each reaction a retaliation. The other governments got dragged in one at a time, and eventually it became system-wide. Stations and colonies were abandoned, personnel were recalled. Some of the transports were destroyed, despite having no military value. Of course, that just escalated things."
The colonel got up and began to pace around his office. The camera at his end kept him perfectly framed.
"At first, the conflict was primarily space-side. Annexation of strategic locations and orbits, denial of assets, that kind of thing. Then the first nuke was used planet-side. And after that, all bets were off."
Colonel Butterworth sat down at his desk and massaged his forehead for a few moments. He reached into a drawer and pulled out what looked very much like a bottle of Jameson. Funny what survives the end of the world. After pouring a glass and taking a sip, he continued,
"It became a war of attrition. Each side tried to neutralize the other's military capability. Then someone nuked most of the Brazilian Empire. Your theory that it was the Chinese is reasonable, and civilian targets became fair game. The ships you took out were the last men standing. Metaphorically speaking, of course, they were only replicants."
The colonel blushed slightly.
No offense meant. In any case, they wouldn't have lasted 5 minutes at the height of the war when everyone still had equipment, but here at the end we had no way to stop them. They just started slowly pounding away at everyone. Call it a scorched earth policy. Call it revenge, whatever. It was genocide. They probably took out a couple of billion people on their own.
I felt ill. I had waited an additional 6 months while Homer and the decoy were assembled. How many people had died for that delay? The colonel had reached the end of his spiel and was concentrating on the glass of Jameson. "So what can we do, Colonel? Help rebuild? Relocate people?"
"I think that ship has sailed, Commander. The Earth will recover eventually. It's tough that way, but not in time for humanity. My tame scientists say it will be minimum 5 to 10,000 years before things recover to any degree. We won't last that long."
Colonel Butterworth touched a control, and a schematic popped up in the video link.
"This is the colony ship we designed and started to build in hopes that our probes would report back with something worth shipping out to. One of the first casualties of the war, I'm afraid. You have on board auto factories that can bootstrap up to a full shipyard. With your help, we'd like to build a couple of these and leave the solar system."
"And go where, specifically?" The colonel sighed.
"I'm actually hoping you'll suggest a destination. It's not like Faith is going to be sending any ships. And you gave me to believe that you have no particular loyalty there."
"And that's true, Colonel. I'm just making sure we're all on the same wavelength." I popped up a star chart of everything within 20 light-years of Earth. You can see the stars rated for likelihood of a habitable planet. Unfortunately, Epsilon Eridani was a failure, unless you want to live under a dome.
By now, Bill may have received reports back from a couple of our ships, but we won't find out for a few more years. Can you last that long?
We have to. It'll take most of a decade to go from a standing start to two colony ships.
I nodded. Okay, then. Let's get this show on the road.
27. Bob, April 2165, Delta Eridani. I patted Spike as I watched the image of the planet slowly build in the holotank. To one side, a schematic of the entire system slowly cycled the planets through their orbits. I couldn't keep a grin off my face. Space exploration was fully living up to my nerd fantasies. Flying into a new star system never before seen by humans was a heady, almost godlike experience. I still couldn't get over the idea that Bill was willing to sit in one system. On the other hand, he would get a chance to do physics and engineering full-time, and he'd be getting regular reports from everyone, albeit at light speed, so he would be participating, at least vicariously. I hoped he'd forward any interesting news to the rest of us. Delta Eridani was an orange star, cooler than Sol, but more than 2.5 times as big. I had deliberately picked this system as my destination because of the high level of suitability. No binary companion, not a flare or variable star, exceptionally long-living stellar type, low in UV emissions, wide potential habitable zone, the list went on and on. The results fully lived up to expectations. I had identified 10 planets, including one in the inner half of the comfort zone. The layout of this system paralleled the Sol system to the point where I suspected there was some universal law at work. The inner planets were all rocky worlds, while the outer were all gas giants, and an asteroid belt divided the two groups. This system, though, contained 5 inner rocky planets, and 2 of the 5 outer gas giants had rings that rivaled Saturn's. The biggest, Jovian, was just stupid big, at about 6 times the mass of Jupiter. I hadn't yet counted all the moons it had collected. And because of the size of their sun, the planets were more spread out, which might explain the large number of moons. Only the innermost planet was missing its own satellite. I was too impatient to follow mission protocol and scan for resources first. I made a beeline for the habitable planet and did a quick survey from orbit. I would take the time to evaluate the results while I did the required but boring raw materials search. Soon, I had completed the orbital scan. I did a quick flyby of the 2 moons. Then, with a sigh, I ordered Guppy to begin the survey of the asteroid belt. Status?
Asteroid belt scan 50% completed. 6 locations identified with significant ore suitable for mining.
That only halfway around? That's pretty good.
Significantly better than Epsilon Eridani or Sol.
I nodded, then turned back to one of my infrared images of the night side of Delta Eridani 4, taken during the orbital survey. Hey, Guppy, look at this here. I materialized an arrow and pointed it to a spot on the picture where several points of light were recorded. Do these look like fires to you?
Probability very high.
You think they're natural? Wildfires?
I am not programmed to have an opinion.
Oh, good Lord. Okay. Then, analysis. List the possible explanations in order of likelihood.
Small local wildfires would be most likely, except...
Yes. Guppy was about to volunteer information. That was definitely a first.
No indication of lightning storms in the area, and the fires do not appear to be spreading. Further investigation is required.
Ha! No argument from me there. Let's get this survey out of the way.
And get the auto factory set up.
Nag, nag. I sat back, bemused, and stared at the slowly rotating planetary image. The survey was soon finished. I flew back to the location of the biggest deposits and began to set up. I unshipped the manufacturing equipment, sent mining roamers to work on the most promising asteroids, and deployed transport drones. I decided that defense was going to be a priority, starting with an early warning system. Accordingly, I manufactured 12 observation drones and sent them to form an icosahedron around the system.
With small shielded reactors, they would spot any incoming craft long before it could possibly detect one of them. Next came the communications station. That routine task could be left to the AMIs. I gave them instructions for construction of the station and further instructions to get started on building Bob's. At some point, I would need to get involved again, but for now, I could leave my devices to their own devices. Snickering at my own wordplay, I headed back to DE4. I dreaded building more Bob's. Just a bit. The first cohort had been a surprise, and not a pleasant one. Milo's self-centeredness had surprised all of us, and although I hadn't said anything to anyone about it, Riker's lack of a sense of humor had bothered me. When I made more Bob's, would I end up with a psychopath? Okay, that was a little over the top. The differences between the Bob's weren't that dramatic. My parents would probably have recognized me in any of them. Mario, for instance, when I was in a situation that I was impatient with, I clammed up just like that. Just maybe not to that extent. All beside the point, though, Bill was right. I would, sooner or later, want company. On the trip out from Epsilon Eridani, I had worked on designs for exploration drones. Bill said he would work on the concept, but I wanted something usable when I got here. If Bill sent along some plans at some point, I'd merge the best of both. Meanwhile, I was at least able to operate. The observation drones were about the size of footballs. They came with remote cameras and microphones, as well as extendable limbs for gripping and perching. More than anything, they reminded me of very large pill bugs. I started on the biological analysis drones as well. They were larger, about a meter in length. They had visual and auditory input optimized for more close-up work, and they had a far larger number of extendable appendages for various tasks. I suppose I could have waited to deploy everything at once, but I simply didn't have that level of patience. The drones could change color to match the background, even to the extent of some limited pattern mimicry. When in the air, they would adjust their bottom half to match the sky and their upper half to match the general terrain. This wasn't out of any fear of getting shot down, more of a concern about some local wildlife attempting to make a meal out of one. The drones were pretty tough, but why borrow trouble? I sent several observation drones to the general area of the fires. As a city boy, I didn't have a true appreciation of how big thousands of square miles of wilderness actually was. This area of the planet was temperate to subtropical forest. Well, I assumed it was forest. Whatever it was, it stretched from horizon to horizon, with occasional breaks for meadows and rocky bluffs. Truthfully, someone flying a small airplane over this wouldn't have been able to tell they weren't on Earth. I felt a momentary pang of homesickness. I realized there was no way I could find anything with a random search. It was late afternoon in this area, so I sent one drone up a kilometer and instructed it to wait for nightfall and look for fires. I sent the other drone down to examine the forest ecosystem close up. The planet was slightly larger than Earth, but had a lower surface gravity, probably due to a smaller core. The gravity, combined with a somewhat denser atmosphere, made for an environment ideal for soaring flyers and tall tree analogs. And the trees had taken advantage of this. The drone landed in a tree, extended its legs, and began to slowly creep along the trunk, and I realized with a start it was really a tree. It was brown, well, brownish, tall, hard, and had branches and leafy things. It looked like a pretty clear case of convergent evolution. It was, in fact, the kind of tree that I loved to climb when I was young. Wide horizontal branchings produced many convenient places to sit. Thick leaf canopies kept the sun off, and the sheer size of the trees was awe-inspiring. I wanted to hug one. The canopy was awash with life. The drone, camouflaged to resemble the tree bark, could snoop on the local wildlife with impunity. I had done an intensive study of taxonomy and cladistics analysis during the voyage, and now found myself evaluating the images with a semi-professional eye. Although the body plans varied wildly in their details, the creatures I was seeing did tend to fall into familiar patterns. Insect analogs were, so far, six-legged and exoskeletal, and seemed to hit a maximum size of slightly larger than a mouse. I found a small furry mammal analog that had 6 legs as well, except for one variant that had 4 legs and wings. I decided to name this particular animal a hippogriff, harkening back to my D&D days. This particular little beastie seemed to have limited ability to change color, to match its background. I watched with amazement as it blended into the tree branch and waited for prey to pass by. I also cataloged many larger mammal analogs that had 4 limbs. They might be an evolutionary branch that had lost the 3rd pair. And there were birds, or again, bird analogs. The bird analogs had what looked very much like feathers. I found it fascinating that the bird things flew like birds and the small furry things flew like bats. It seemed that aerodynamics had a lot to say about animal flight here, just as on Earth. There was even a snake equivalent, which interestingly seemed to be mammalian on this planet. It looked like the 3-segment body plan had been multiplied to considerable length. I found everything fascinating and was paradoxically irritated when Guppy interrupted.
Heat and light sources detected.
A schematic popped up on the holotank. All right, multiples. Have the drones set up as close as they can while remaining hidden. Let's see what we've got. Deployment took about 30 minutes. The drones needed to be careful not to attract attention by rattling the vegetation or banging into things. They needed to find a good place of concealment using night vision, which was notoriously subpar for detail work. Eventually, though, the units were in position. Surveillance from several different vantage points showed groups of animals gathered around fires. No, not animals. Beings. Some of the beings were tending the fires, while others seemed to be handling small objects in purposeful ways. While it was far too soon to form any detailed conclusions, I was pretty certain that these were, at minimum, fire users.
Well, that's it for this planet as a colonization target, I guess.
I held my fists in the air in triumph. I just discovered intelligent, non-human life. Not technological yet, but so what? This was huge! I wondered if I had first contact dibs. I would have to send a message off to Bill soonest. The natives were not pretty from a human-centric perspective. I decided that the best description would be a bat-pig mashup. Limbs were longer than seemed reasonable, giving them a spiderish appearance. They had a light coat of fur, which varied in color from a light brownish gray to an orangey tan. The faces and heads had varied color patterns, topped by a pair of very mobile and expressive ears. The rest of the body tended to be monochromatic. I kept up a running stream of commentary for my reports to Bill. I smiled to myself as I pictured him as a spider, sitting in the center of his web, listening to the vibrations on the various strands. I can see a couple of infants nursing at an adult's, breast. I don't want to make assumptions, but I guess if it's for nursing, it's a breast. I can't assume it's milk either, although it's a pretty safe bet that it's for nourishment. I also can't assume that the adult is a female or that it's the child's parent. I'm tentatively assigning tags to each individual based on their fur patterns. I looked over at Guppy, who stood at the ready. While I wasn't an expert on reading fish expressions, I thought I detected occasional interest in my observations. I hoped so. For all the joy of having the universe as my playground, I had to admit that it was lonely. I took a deep breath and resumed my verbal annotations. There are 6 groups, each of which maintains its own fire. They seem friendly, and there is frequent interaction between individual members, but the groups seem to remain distinct. I've instructed one of the drones to get in close enough to pick up sounds. I'm pretty sure they're talking to each other. I turned to Guppy. Any problem with sending roamers down?
Roamers are not intended as exploration units.
That doesn't answer my question.
Guppy rolled his eyes. Guppy actually rolled his eyes. Rolling eyes on a giant fish head were truly epic.
Roamers are not designed for exploration on planetary surfaces. Although they have the capability, they would not be maximally efficient. Cameras are small aperture and designed for close-in work. Auditory sensitivity is rudimentary. There is no infrared capability. They have no flight capability and would not be able to camouflage themselves.
Damn, good answer. Okay, Guppy, thanks.
I exist to serve.
I laughed out loud. No one was going to convince me that wasn't sarcasm. Great poker face, though.